Welcome, or welcome back. I'm Artie Young, curmudgeon trader in tales of the life and times of the 1950s and 60s as a warm, idyllic time worth reminiscing about in these weekly episodes of this podcast project known to many as the Primrose Chronicles. And this is episode 221, and it's entitled, Not It, or Night Games, After the Streetlights Came On. Though my purview of these times have often been called a rose-colored look through a far too nostalgic lens of recollection, I continue to post tales that I hope will offer a respite from a world that takes itself and opinions far too seriously. So if you're looking for a bully pulpit, a debate stage, or a soapbox, this isn't it. However, if you'd like to lean into some topics that might just make you smile or fondly remember, I'll be trying to make this your place for the next 20 minutes or so. In a couple of weeks, I'll be devoting our time together to the summer heat. It'll be the dog days of summer by then, and my stories and anecdotes should serve to have you saying against present temperatures, hot, let me tell you about hot, and then I'll help you finish the comparison. Today, though, I want to look back, especially on Primrose Avenue, as one of the five young offspring and over 100 kids who occupied the homes between 44th and 45th Street several years in that split decade, 1955 to 1965. More specifically, the neighborhood activities that came at the end of every sweltering hot summer day, intended as a cool down before heading into our respective abodes for the night, but in fact, often heightening external body temperature and internal emotional temperature, resulting in sweating and arguments and even fisticuffs in certain instances. What am I talking about? Night games. Those contests and activities that required a level of darkness to make them interesting, even while producing a level of coolness that had been sought ever since the noonday heat. The natural cooling of the sun going down, the breezes, and the drop-in humidity seemed to produce a new life within the kids of Primrose and then comparable blocks in towns across our nation this time of year. Events seemed to take place in differing stages or acts, some occurring before the older kids had to arrive in the neighborhood confines, in other words, before the streetlights came on. Until they began arriving from different directions, the front yard game surface belonged to those who would soon be turning in, and while there was just enough light for the watchful eyes of their moms to focus on their antics. Now, throughout every evening, mothers would be the monitors of gameplay, interpreting the rules and enforcing them, but this time was just a warm-up for that. These were the moments when early-age schoolchildren learned the rules and the nomenclature of contests that they would be playing in earnest when they could stay up and would be invited into the more mature competitions. For now, the games would be short, explanations would be brief, and participation would be just enough. Generally, however, these games were put aside as children became distracted by what was going on in the air around them. As the summer evening shadows fell across the front yards of Maple Downs, the growing darkness was accentuated by rapid flashes of light. Yep, I'm talking about lightning bugs. Okay, call them fireflies if you want, but you're obviously not from Indiana and probably not from the Midwest if you do. Anyway, these winged, incandescent insects were fascinating, to the point of children chasing around the flashpoint, gently capturing one in their hands, watching them light up again through their fingers, and then releasing them to catch and observe another. More energetic junior entomologists passed through the swarms with glass ball jars, swishing the open top through the air and trapping several at one time, resulting in a centralized location for watching those tail ends brighten and then go dim. On a good night, dozens of bug hunters could fill dozens of jars. They were that prominent in the air just above the ground. And for a few moments, the activity garnered the attention of young children, enthralled by the natural light show. But that was often also just enough for parents to declare victory and to march the youngest of the brood inside for a washdown. Probably not a bath, it wasn't Saturday night, and then into their PJs. Some nights they were then allowed to rejoin the festivities, all ready for bed, but also confined to the porch stoop or patio. And with that, the curtain came down on the opening act. Now by this time, those who'd been distant from home at ball games or midweek church events, friends' homes in other neighborhoods, trees or clubhouses or abandoned building, they all began to dribble in. Oh yeah, I've got a story or two in the offing about my experiences in a couple of those places. Anyway, these were permitted excursions as long as the streetlights weren't on yet. Now, many an argument and negotiation regarding violations and subsequent restrictions hinged on the issue of the streetlights. In fact, it came down to which light was on which corner because some came on earlier than others. To discover a loophole like a streetlight being out seldom bought you more than a few minutes reprieve, but anyway, it wasn't such a bad thing to be home when the lights came on. It was always a pleasurable pastime, for a few minutes anyway, to toss shoes and ball gloves and the like up toward the bulb and watch the bats, the flying kind, swoop toward it thinking it was a giant insect or something. And it was something to do while we waited for our younger siblings to clear the yards so that the serious Olympiad of lawn contests could begin. But soon enough, it was time for the main events. Mills' yard and ours had for years been considered, for playing purposes, a single entity. It was identified as two parcels for the sake of mowing, and the common boundary between the lots was defined for restriction purposes. If I was disciplinarily confined to my yard for a number of days, that did not include the Mills' yard, and the same was true for any of their five. It could also be divided for night games, affording participants two contests to consider, and thus breaking up the gaggle that had gathered for one last event of the day. The choices were somewhat varied evening to evening, dependent upon the predominant age range present. If there was a preponderance of primary kids, the games were a little tamer. Mother, or father, may I, often provided the first entertainment. If they could walk and take instruction, then the kid was old enough to play. Usually, an older girl, seldom a guy, assumed the role of the parent on the stoop or in a lawn chair up by the house. The kids lined up along the sidewalk by the street. Too many participants meant a long time between turns, as each player, one at a time, received instructions for moving forward to the mother-father figure and home base. This meant that giant steps directed needed to be taken to cover the greatest distance without becoming a giant leap. And regular steps should be of a normal stride. Baby steps were scrutinized as to whether they were, in fact, appropriate for a toddler. Skip steps needed to look like its namesake, as with a gallop step or a shuffle step, usually directed in multiples. Then there were the more intricate strides. Umbrella steps could cover a very long distance, since you could leap and land without penalty of retreat as long as one finger remained affixed to the top of your head through the completion and at least one twirl while in the air. Your landing spot for the next round instruction would be where you touch down, not where you fell to. Another dangerous motion forward was sometimes commanded by the parent figure, usually a boy, as payback for something that had happened earlier in the day or even a day or week previous. It was the dreaded instruction, "Move forward, one fall on my command." So at the end of a countdown, 3, 2, 1, when so directed, with hands stretched above head, one fell forward toward the finish line. The first body part hitting the ground farthest forward was the place where you began your next term, after everyone playing had had theirs in that same round. the very trait that probably prompted the game's mother or father to issue the potentially self-injuring instruction in the first place was what made this command so diabolical. In a sense, they used the player's own competitive drive against them. You see, since the greatest distance covered was achieved if hands hit in a reach almost simultaneous to your face, in other words, a veritable faceplant, that would be the best move. But if you bent your arms and brought them down from the shoulders to protect your countenance, it was safer, but a more limited amount of ground was covered. Yes, height mattered. Arm length, it mattered, but it all came down to your determination, your resolve, and your level of concern for your forehead, your nose, your front teeth, or your chin. What was it going to be? That was your call. And regardless of fall, safety, and an unwillingness to risk the face, from the position of game parent, you could still exact some measure of revenge. If it only came because the proper move at least meant landing either in tall grass or just mowed clippings, with each abounding with chiggers. That'd work. Oh yeah, the most essential thing, though, to remember in this game was your use of the name of the game. Every move, whether to your great advantage or otherwise, could only be attempted after you asked mother or father, "May I?" and you received the positive response, "Yes, you may." Now, at the sole prerogative of the authority issuing the commands, an alternate answer could be issued. "Mother, may I?" "No, you may not." And a new instruction could be given. And this could go on as long as the one with the power of "you may" or "you may not" chose to have it do so. Or until a true parental arbiter spoke up from the patio and said, "Marty, that's enough," and the game could then continue. But if a player was in a hurry to perform his step, or had become flustered or frustrated in his or her interactions with the overbearing game master or mistress, and forgot to say, "Mother, may I?" a return to the starting line was the penalty, and the path of leaps and twirls and falls began afresh, to say nothing of the embarrassment derived from such a basic game faux pas. Eventually, one competitor successfully traversed the path forward with its commands, reached the parental chair, and was declared the winner or the favorite child. Usually one game of Mother May I was more than enough, for reasons probably obvious to anyone watching or, in this podcast case, listening. It reeked of entitlement and favoritism and unfair advantages. In other words, the perfect preparation for future life. Though that might be the last of Mother May I for the night, it could now easily morph into another similar, yet different path up the yard from sidewalk to stoop, and that game was green light, red light. Remember it? Again, one sat upon the designated home location, and again, multiple kids lined up across the sidewalk. For those of the old neighborhood, visualizing the contest at 4425, that would be east to west. For the rest of you, it really doesn't matter, wherever you had the longest, clearest sight line. A little more strategy and cunning was also required, making it a step up from the earlier game. And this fact alone drew more of us older youth to play. Because, you see, we knew the tricks that might earn us the victory. To understand the strategy required understanding the rules. One person was it. He controlled the length of a green light and the suddenness of a red. Unlike public streets, there was no yellow in between. The green light instruction was made with its eyes closed. The directive remained in effect until his eyes flew open and a red light was declared. The children, simulating vehicles, raced up the yard at the first order and came to an abrupt stop ahead of the crimson injunction. Yard travelers who were seen still in motion by it were so identified and, as in Mother May I, were sent back to the starting grid to begin again. Pretty straightforward, but still played with some strategy. Night gamers in the know always set up on the ends of the race line. This way, when it looked up from his or her green light announcement with a red light declaration, it was probably looking to the center of the course, giving the outside lanes less likelihood of detection. As those caught any moving violation on the red light were pointed out, the other side of the line, taking full advantage of their baby step skills from the previous game, could inch closer and closer, even though the red light was the command. Hey, you've all done it in a full-blown car when you're in a hurry and you think nobody's looking. Or was that just me? In either situation, getting caught meant serious consequence. In the latter, a ticket, a fine, or the like. In the former, it was back to the starting line. One other way to reach the traffic signal chair was if a novice to the green light, red light contest was it. You see, you listened carefully when a newbie was in the chair, because commands meant everything. You might hear, "Red light," shouted out by the eyes-closed traffic controller. Less attentive, took off at the first command, and when the second command was made by the same, now with eyes open, they screeched to a stop. Those with ears wide open recognized that a mistake in call had been made, and that in truth, any and all could race to the traffic director's chair, with the first one touching becoming the new it. Now, maybe you weren't listening carefully either. I know a lot of other stuff gets done while I'm talking to you, as important as I think my narrative is, so listen again. There is a difference between green light, red light, and red light, green light. Still not hearing it? Oh, you're never going to master it then. Let's just go on. This was probably the last game played in twilight. Although others could be substituted, there were the different games of tag, and in each of them, there was no benefit for being it. It usually meant trying to reach or tag others before they could reach a base or a safe zone or assume a position that would make them impervious to its tags. And that's why one of the kids with the most forceful demeanor, in other words, think Lucy in the Peanuts comic strip, would say, 1, 2, 3, not it! And the last to say it, as agreed upon by the mini mob, was just that. At least until he or she could change it with a legal tag. For one version of tag, and there were multiple, the maple tree over by the drive and down near the sidewalk was a base. That was because the adults didn't want the rambunctiousness of zealous crumb crunchers to overturn iced teas or ashtrays on the patio up near the house. But in that game, no more than three could be safe at one time by touching the tree's trunk. And if the number was exceeded, someone already resting there had to take their hand off ahead of being tagged by it. As one can imagine, a cluster of hands came on and off the tree, and the frustrated its tags became more and more forceful. And just before, or just after tears and wails erupted, another shout from the mom squad on the patio announced, "Play something else." Usually, it was something still in the tag genre. Like I said, the options were limitless. There was squat tag, where a player could be chased and just before getting tagged, could squat or stoop and escape being the next it. In a reverse variation of stoop tag, there was freeze tag, where any player tagged by it was frozen on the spot and in position, left to stand motionless until another could unfreeze him or her, while the freeze tagger went in search of others to put in a state of imagined hypothermia. Now, most of the time, the frozen condition did not last long, being thawed by another player, but sometimes one remained an ice sculpture for maybe the whole game, because of another one of those things that happened earlier in the day that we decided to get even for. Now, if I remember, the normal freeze tag game went on until it decided he or she was through being so declared and basically quit. But were we ready to call it a night? By no means. The herd of kids that had now been thinned by bedtime preparation for the youngest and declarations of "I quit" by those with weaker psyches and resolve meant that all that remained for the hardcore night gamers on the unofficial schedule of the evening were two serious games, maybe three if there was time. First, there was almost always Red Rover, with its dangers to noses, windpipes, and occasional dislocated elbows. Younger listeners may be unfamiliar with this yard or playground game. It was stricken from PE curriculum and forbidden as a recess activity by insurance companies having to handle liability claims. But it still surfaces in neighborhoods today that don't have HOAs. Two captains, again, probably a Lucy Van Pelt type, and whoever she had deemed her friend for the day, took turns selecting from the remaining individuals. First chosen were the largest and the fastest. Those deemed toughest, in this case able to take a blow, were also early choices. And so it went back and forth until all were selected and the teams were more or less even. For this, the playing field was rotated 90 degrees, and the two teams faced each other from the north and south sides of the yard, driveway and property line, with public sidewalk and patio with stoop being side boundaries. Captains, with suggestions from warriors of former Red Rover Wars, lined up their troops. The smallest? Not necessarily just girls because, hey, some of those girls were from the asphalt playgrounds of the Catholic school. But the smallest were usually placed between larger combatants. A quick lesson was given on how to link arms, not hand in hand, but hand to forearm by each. And then the sides were ready. The calling team decided on a subject from the other that they thought could not penetrate their line, even at the weakest point. And the first shout to battle was made. Red Rover, send Wendy right over, or whoever had been determined least likely to break through their ranks. Wendy would then drop arms with her compatriots, perhaps take a step or two back, and propel herself toward the set of hands that she thought, or her team had advised her, might be the most porous. She reached the human chain at full speed. If the human fetters held, she became a new human link in that same chain. If she should break through at any spot, she could choose any human link to take back with her to be a part of her team. Either way, it was now the opposing team's turn to call someone over. Because of additions and or subtractions, folks were moved around and over again came the repetition of the first battle cry, Red Rover, Red Rover, and a combatant from the other team was challenged to breach an arm gap. These call-outs continued until, in theory, two teams had become one, either through assimilation or in some cases attrition caused by painful collisions. Now, one other game favorite was Fox and Hens, and for this one, the it was designated the fox, who was the predator of all the other gamers who were the chickens. And this scenario transformed the front yard into a barnyard with open space on one side, hen house on the other. Oh, come on, use your imagination. The yard by the driveway and the property line of 4425 and 4429 as the hen house. And in this scenario, the chickens found themselves, as night was falling, a distance from the hen house, and they had to safely scurry home to avoid being captured in the paws of the fox. And here's where it got weird. Once securely in the grasp of the fox, and after the others had reached the hen house without harm, an inexplicable transformation took place for the next pasture to hen house run in pursuit. The now captured hen became a fox, and there were now two. And that would likely result in two more chickens subdued during the next race, now making four, and lessening the hen and rooster population by the same number. Each trek across the barnyard reduced the capon population exponentially, while increasing the number of tods and vixens similarly. Do the math, and you see that eventually, the remaining few chickens would meet their demise in one final swoop across the yard, or a lone banty would succumb to the insurmountable odds of the entire skulk of foxes. Either way, it ended the game. The participating Primrosians for any further games that evening were in all likelihood of the older variety, with a handful of slightly junior participants who were all in for the main event of the darkening evening. That would be hide and seek. Now, this was a game you really didn't want to be it. It required you to count, usually by fives in a loud sing-song voice to an agreed-upon multiple of 100, 100, 200, 300, 500, whatever. And this served as a backdrop for the company of kids who would go into hiding, knowing when the seeker was free to go looking for the hiders. Now, the latter often spent the entire day looking for just the right spot in which to conceal or camouflage their location. Ideally, they would wait out the efforts of the seeker as hiding places were discovered by the it until finally the game was declared over. All still out could come in free, and winners were declared. Should a hider be discovered, he or she could still be considered safe by outracing the it to reach the home base and shouting free ahead of the dreaded declaration, "I spy Marty," or whoever, while touching the home base. An interesting aside that will go undeveloped for this tale was the realization that in time, the older participants often played this game on an even more serious level. It would be discovered upon conclusion that certain upper elementary contestants had chosen to hide together, think duos, and had in fact found hiding places outside the agreed upon game boundaries and did not immediately come to home base, even though the all-free announcement had been clearly made, finally returning hand in hand or arm in arm. But that's a night game discussion for another episode. For now, I only hope I've stirred the memories, maybe brought to the surface of your recollections the organized activities that were transformed into competitions and helped while away the hours of those summer months between the end of Little League, summer vacations, weeks of scout and church camp, without which we might have even been ready to go back to school. Speaking of games, I know a number of you have ordered that great new board game of Baby Boom Trivia Boom Again, where all the questions are about the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and everyone I've spoken with say they're surprised, one, at the high quality of the game components, and even as the game itself being hilarious, fun, and addictive to play in games. Now, I just checked with our last TPC guest, that was Brian Hirsch, board game guru and the inventor of Boom Again, and the 25% discount code is still available for Chronicles listeners. So go to boomagain.com and enter Primrose25 to get your own board game while that's still available, as well as making a few perfect gifts for friends and siblings of that era. Now, if you're not a boomer, you might be at a disadvantage playing the game, but play with your folks or your grandparents and learn about what you think is ancient history and what we call the good old days. And while you're at it, it's the perfect holiday gift for that senior that you don't know what to buy. As you get yours and as you plan your Boom Again get-togethers, let me know how they went. I've got a couple planned here in our neighborhood, and I will certainly update you on how that goes. Well, I guess that covers everything. Episodes ahead will be more consistent. One is about Hoosier humidity. One is about how this Primrose Chronicles is becoming a worldwide phenomenon. A conversation to get the girls' take on the fads, music, shopping, sleepovers, clothing styles, and whatever else three baby boomer ladies want to go into is ahead for an interview not far off. Back to school shopping will be memorialized in another TPC telling, and several other interviews will dot the fall schedule. So thank you again for being a loyal fan and for rolling with my experiments. All in all, I, for one, have been pleased. And if you're enjoying your listens, will you share this link with friends and formally follow the Primrose Chronicles on your favorite podcast app? There are some pretty exciting opportunities that are beginning to pop up for this project and yours truly, a few of which are dependent on listener numbers. So again, I would really appreciate your support. Well, with that, I think I've given even the most serious pre-adolescent couple a chance to come wandering back without the parent posse sending out their own search party. And of course, there's always tomorrow evening to start the post-supper activities, from lightning bugs to snuggle bugs. Another summer night on Primrose Lane, or Primrose Avenue. Blessings.